Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
General Electric makes jet engines and railroad cars, kitchen equipment, and light bulbs, of course. It owns NBC and Universal Pictures. It's got a huge financial services division, too, which is where the trouble comes in. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. And by Lions for Lambs, starring Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, and Robert Redford, on DVD today.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. Today is the 11th of April, and it is not the best time, as we all know, to be in the financial business. So maybe it shouldn't have been such a shock when GE reported a 6% drop in first quarter profits this morning. But shock it was, and if there's one thing Wall Street doesn't like, it is surprises, especially when it's the third largest company in the world bringing bad things to light. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
He insisted he wasn't making excuses, but GE chief Jeffrey Immelt was doing an awful lot of explaining today as he was grilled by analysts during a conference call. How was it, they wanted to know, that as recently as a March 12th webcast, he was promising a strong 10% rise in earnings despite the weakening economy? Today, Immelt pointed to worries over a near meltdown of the financial system a few days later.
I don't want this to be a company that's about excuses, but 2 days after the webcast, the weekend of the Bear Stearns situation took place. You know, the last 2 weeks of March were a different world, particularly in financial services.
As it turns out, Immelt says now the company fell victim to those unusually disruptive circumstances, which complicated the sale of certain assets and unexpectedly changed its expected bottom line. But some analysts noted that profits were down at four of GE's six divisions, not just financial services, and some questioned whether it's really the economy and the credit crisis or if it's more of a problem with GE itself. One analyst compared GE to the Chicago Cubs.
Every year, it's next year.
GE is financial manager James Hardesty's biggest equity holding, but Hardesty says he's hopeful this is a one-time problem.
Tempers don't make money in the stock market. When the day is done and we take the final tally, it's how well this company is being run for the long term.
He says he's disappointed that Immelt has now lowered GE's profit outlook for the entire year. Hardesty says there will be limits to his patience with a company that's been so reliable over the years. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Nothing says weekend like kicking back and throwing something on the grill. But if wild salmon is what you're hungry for, pull out your wallet and get ready for $35 a pound. Fishermen here on the West Coast have voted to cancel the Chinook or King salmon season. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has already declared a state of emergency. West Coast fishermen figure they'll lose at least $150 million as a result of the fishing ban.
We're hoping to get some federal disaster relief.
Zeke Grader is executive director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. Grader says some federal officials blame poor ocean conditions, but they should also look at the rivers where the Chinook spawn. Grader says take California. Over half the state now depends on the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta for its drinking and irrigation water. He says those huge water diversions are already damaging fish populations.
We've been arguing for years that it was time to begin decentralizing our water system and diversifying it, not just to protect the salmon, but to actually ensure that we have a stable water supply in the future.
That hasn't happened, he says. Instead, West Coast farmers and growing cities have long been beating out the fish. But conservationists hope the decline of the treasured and tasty king salmon will highlight the West's water supply problems and force long-term solutions. Conservationist Joseph Bogard works on salmon recovery efforts.
What we need is the leadership to make the tough decisions.
And that could mean everything from strict water use mandates in cities to even sharper cutbacks to farmers. A judge's ruling last year has already begun restricting water supplies to some growers in the San Joaquin Valley. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Want to know how big a deal the GE thing was? You have to go back to the crash of 87 to find a similar drop in GE shares, almost 13% today. It's a Dow component, too, which virtually guarantees the sad music. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. This is probably a pretty easy thing to say if you're a guy who's raked in $234 million so far. But today, Barack Obama called the public presidential campaign financing system creaky. That's the one funded by the checkoff box on your tax returns. Obama and John McCain are going back and forth over who said what about whether either one of them might take public money in the general election. Today in Washington, a federal court revisited earlier campaigns. It's considering a case that would overturn some Watergate-era laws limiting fundraising and spending by political groups. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes us back to Election 04.
Remember MoveOn.org? How about those Swift Boat Veterans for Truth ads that helped sink John Kerry? Well, they're back. A new wave of outside political groups is churning out new ads targeting Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain.
If speeches could create jobs, we wouldn't
she
be facing a recession.
She is steeped in controversy, steeped in sleaze.
We need a new direction, not the next same old thing.
The groups behind these ads are using the same old mixed strategy. They're accepting unlimited donations. Then they run ads gunning for specific candidates. You're not supposed to do that. If you're a political group wanting to influence an election and you accept unlimited funding, you can't tell voters who to vote for. Groups like Swift Boat and Move On got in trouble for that in 2004. The government eventually fined them, although the penalties amounted to only 1% of what was spent illegally. But one of the new groups thinks even small fines are too much. It's called SpeechNow.org. It's not ignoring campaign finance laws. It's trying to overturn them.
Candidates don't like people coming in from the outside saying anything about their election race. But we think that's what the First Amendment's all about.
That's SpeechNow President David Keating. He says his group should be able to raise as much money as it wants and say whatever it wants. Those are the rules for millionaires. There are no limits on what an individual can spend or say on the airwaves. But if two or more people want to band together to influence an election, their contributions are limited to $5,000. Keating says that's not fair.
So why can't a few of us get together and pool a lot less than $1 million each into a pot so we can collectively match what the millionaires are able to say?
But Paul Ryan, a lawyer with the Campaign Legal Center, says it's not that simple. He says outside groups can use money from unnamed donors, corporations, for example, to attack candidates while obscuring the real source of their money. An individual can't do that.
Courts have found, going back at least to the 1970s, that large contributions can corrupt candidates and parties, perhaps through outside, allegedly independent organizations.
Keating insists that SpeechNow will be independent and won't take any money from unions or corporations. But another group that Keating directs doesn't disclose all of its donors. The anti-tax group Club for Growth says it has more than 40,000 members. Keating says where the money comes from isn't the point. Outside political groups should be able to say whatever they want based on First Amendment free speech rights. Remember this ad from Swift Boat Veterans in 2004?
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
So this speech is helpful, not harmful.
But Paul Ryan of the Campaign Legal Center says there's no absolute right to free speech. Loyola Law School professor Rick Hassan thinks the SpeechNow case might have to go all the way to the Supreme Court to decide that question.
This case, more than any others that have come down in recent years, really has the potential to open up the ability for much more money to flow into the electoral process than we've already seen, if that's even possible to believe.
If SpeechNow wins, money will talk in future elections like never before.
Paid for by American Leadership Project, which is responsible.
Campaign to defend America's responsible.
ClubForGrowth.net is responsible for the content of this advertising.
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genser for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson back in Dallas, Texas. And I have to tell you, David, it seems like forever since we've talked to you and me.
I know. Yeah, well, I would have put it off another week or so, given the kind of week we've had.
Right.
This week, I don't know why this week waited until now to get ugly. I mean, obviously, the GE thing was just a horrible surprise. But, you know, we've had these little signs all week long. UPS.
Yep.
When was that? I guess it was a couple of days ago. Yep. UPS cut their earnings estimate. UPS is a good operator, you know, and they blame the economy. They blame fuel prices. Yesterday, JCPenney came out and said same-store sales were below expectations, and they didn't see, you know, an end in sight right away to the economic slowdown. And
now this morning we have the big kahuna, GE. I mean, everybody was surprised, but how come?
Well, because GE doesn't do this. I mean, for one thing. I mean, I think that's part of it. I think it was the cumulative effect, though, because here you have GE who never misses their numbers. They're really diversified. They're in every company. They're in every kind of business. And for them to come out was such a miss. And clearly, a lot of it was financial. I mean, the wake of this Bear Stearns stuff. And if this were sort of the end of the earnings parade,
yeah.
And GE came back and said, oh, by the way, we lost our shirt. No, this is the beginning of the parade.
Hold on, though. See, now I'm going to turn you back on yourself. You ready?
Okay.
All right, here it goes. You always say, you know, investors were looking for a reason to buy today when there is no other information out there. And now I'm going to posit that perhaps they were looking for a reason to sell.
Well, okay. I'll go with that. But here's the little bit of twist.
All right.
Is only the sellers showed up. Did you see the volume today?
No, actually. What was it?
$1,263,000,000. So that's below normal trading. And actually, it's been below normal trading all week long. There were just no buyers out there. There were lots of sellers, and you have that sort of an illiquid market, and you just drop like a rock, which is exactly what happened. So now we sit back and sort of figure, you know, who's next? We've got lots of financial companies reporting next week. Well, you know, you're not going to hear a lot of good news there.
Yeah.
Maybe another airline will fold. Who knows? Just, you know, for a little bit of comic relief.
Yeah, let me get your perspective on that, actually, the whole airline thing, because you are a closet airline geek.
I've covered airlines for a long time. I was with a film crew. We were inside Braniff when they stopped flying years ago.
That's not good.
Well, I mean, I wasn't responsible for it. Made for a good story.
What's your take, though, specifically about all these budget airlines?
Well, I mean, the problem is, what we're going to have to get back to for any of these guys to be able to make any money is monopolies. And you don't like it because we've all learned that competition is good. It brings down prices, but it brings down prices so much. I mean, this industry is suicidal on its best days. And it brings down prices so much that nobody can make a living. And then all of a sudden, you can't get to grandma's house or make your meeting, you know, in New York City in the morning.
And over the woods and through the hill to grandmother's house. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sheared off 2% today, 256 points, to close at 12,325. The NASDAQ sliced off 2.6%, 61 points, to end at 2290. The S&P 500 gave back 2%, 27 points, finished at 1332. There for the week, the Dow fell 2.3%. The NASDAQ returned 3.4%. The S&P 500 lost 2.7%. Plummeting consumer confidence added to the carnage. J.P. Morgan lost 3%. Lehman Brothers chipped off nearly 1%. Washington Mutual lost more than 4% today after Goldman Sachs took the unusual step of recommending investors short those shares. That's not good. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for March. On April 14, 1828, after more than two decades of work, Noah Webster published his American Dictionary of the English Language. And the Breakfast Club's Anthony Michael Hall celebrates his birthday. The Boston-born actor turns 40. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, what would you rather do? Have somebody tell you what the rules of the game are or have a chance to make them up yourself? Some of the country's biggest drug companies and medical device makers have voted for option B, thanks. They've decided to disclose how much money they're giving doctors and advocacy groups who prescribe or recommend the use of their products. And no, it's no coincidence that Congress is considering rules about improper influences in medical care. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
Republican Senator Charles Grassley is sponsoring a bill to require industry disclosure. He recently asked more than a dozen companies to voluntarily reveal their payments, and most said they'll begin this summer. Natasha Rosario at Columbia University's Center on Medicine especially welcomes finding out about industry backing for nonprofit advocacy groups, such as the American Heart Association or American Diabetes Association.
There is a conflict of interest when we don't know whether the products they promote or the policies they promote are because of their ties with industry rather than for what is good for the public interest.
But Peter Lurie at Public Citizens Health Research Group doesn't hold out much promise for voluntary disclosure.
This would be a step in the right direction if the companies actually complied. What we're more likely to see is a scattershot approach with various companies disclosing various things.
Reliable disclosure, he says, can only come from a government mandate. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Most of us use our credit cards for everything from the mundane to the exotic, everyday groceries and celebratory dinners. Corporate cards are the same way, from routine expense account items to $500 dinners with clients, tickets to that sold-out Broadway show or late-night stops at some hot new nightclub, and all in the name of business. Those days are gone with the down economy. Companies are cutting back, and Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports they just got a new way of policing your plastic.
Say your company gives you a corporate credit card, but they don't want you whipping it out at a bar or at some swanky department store. MasterCard's new in-control card limits the use of your plastic to certain kinds of businesses.
It's really like a remote control. You turn it on when you want it on, you turn it off.
That's credit card industry analyst Jim Van Dyke.
That's what the in-control announcement is all about, letting the cardholder shut off transactions.
And letting the boss know via text message what you've used it for. Steve Abrams of MasterCard says the company's banking on the card to give it a bigger piece of the corporate card market, where it lags behind Visa and American Express.
Wow, if you look at the business-to-business market opportunity in the U.S., I think it's about $14 to $17 trillion.
Of course, MasterCard won't be stopping at the corporate market. The next target for the card that lets you limit where it's used and tattles on you when you use it is obvious. Parents. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The same thing that happened with corn in this country is happening with other grains around the world. Rising prices are bringing bigger crops. Global grain yield is expected to top 2 billion tons this year. All the same, the United Nations said today those higher prices are going to be around for the foreseeable future. And as we've told you, that's brought riots to some countries where food's both expensive and in short supply. The World Bank has taken special interest in the cost of food for the poorest among us. It'll be on the agenda this weekend at the bank's annual meeting. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is a managing director for the bank, and I asked her earlier today what she sees as the biggest problem with those high prices.
I think the biggest problem is the impact that these rising food prices have on the poorest populations and the poor countries of the world. You know, as prices have gone up for some products by more than 85%, you know, in the last few years, and even recently rice prices have skyrocketed.
What is at stake, then, if these prices keep on going up or perhaps even don't come down a little bit?
Well, at stake is the fact that developing countries' efforts to fight poverty and the attempt to reach the Millennium Development Goals on poverty by 2015 could be jeopardized. Because as Bob Zelig, president of the World Bank, said yesterday, you know, this rise in food prices sets back the fight on poverty by 7 years. This is pretty dramatic.
He's also called, Mr. Zelig has, for a new deal to fix rising world food prices. What might that consist of?
Well, this new global deal is an attempt to get countries behind a set of interventions or measures to get emergency food aid to some of these countries where riots are occurring or where there are problems. Secondly, we look at medium and longer term interventions. It's apparent that these high food prices are here to stay for some time. So how do we work with countries, particularly in Africa, in Haiti, in other areas where these food prices are beginning to hit? The World Bank is going to double its investment in agriculture to $800 million. We're working closely with both the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, with the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, to develop country plans that we can support for improving agriculture.
I'm wondering if we could talk about Africa specifically for a minute and some of the goals that Bob Zelig, your boss, has for economic growth there.
African countries are doing better. They are growing at better than 5% now, which they've not done for a couple of decades, and they want to improve on this growth. That needs more investment in infrastructure, in water resources so that people can have water to irrigate their farms and water to drink. So what does this mean? This is why Bob Zelig is calling for sovereign wealth funds to put about 1% of their resources investing in Africa, because actually there are good returns to be made on the continent in regional infrastructure projects. So if there's $3 trillion in these sovereign wealth funds, 1%, $30 billion towards supporting Africa would be a very good thing.
What's your sense of how worried regional governments are about this rising cost of food?
My sense is they're quite worried. I mean, if we don't act as a global community, you have a potentially destabilizing effect on some countries. And it's those countries least able to cope with this crisis.
Are you worried at all about the prospect of having to work through governments that might have other interests at heart besides actually getting food to the people in Haiti? That has been an issue, and some other governments in Africa and East Asia?
Well, let me hasten to say that while you may have governments with other interests, it's rare to see a government that is not interested in feeding its people. Because you know the consequences of going hungry are immediately apparent.
Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is a managing director at the World Bank. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Eight Palestinians were killed by Israeli raids in the Gaza Strip today. The airstrikes were the latest in back-and-forth attacks that have been happening all week. Over the years, Palestinians who can have left Gaza and the West Bank, an estimated 300,000 of them, now live in Lebanon. Palestinians make up about 10% of the population there, but they still have trouble getting jobs and buying property, so they're left to find economic opportunities where they can. Don Duncan reports now from the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp.
When you hear the word camp, you may think of tents. And that's how it all started 60 years ago. That's when Israel was created, sending thousands of Palestinians to Lebanon where they pitched their tents and waited to return. Over the years, the tents morphed into a concrete ghetto of busy streets, and a vibrant marketplace was born.
That's where I would go to shop every week. I used to buy clothes for the children and things for the house. Food, house supplies, sometimes utensils.
For 60-year-old Hanin Rafe, the camp near her town was a kind of half-price destination. Bread inside the camp cost 60 cents. Outside, it cost a dollar. Cigarettes, $4 versus $7 everywhere else. But the bombing last May changed that. A conflict between the army and Islamic militants reduced the camp to rubble, scattering the residents and the market. The camp Nahr el-Bared was a key commercial hub for the northern region of Lebanon. The camp generated about $100 million in sales annually, making life cheaper for up to a quarter of a million people in the area.
Palestinians ask for very, very little profits.
That's Ismail Hassan, a local architect and urban planner.
They transform a room of their house into a shop, so they don't have to pay money to create a shop. They work in it themselves, the father, the son, the daughter, so they don't have to pay money for people.
But there was another reason the camp was an economic hub, the black market. There was no sales tax or import duty. Most of the products were smuggled from nearby Syria. This drove down the cost of services across the north. Cheap supplies from the camp fueled construction, healthcare and the clothing industry. So when the bombs fell on the camp and its black market, prices in neighbouring towns kept rising long after the dust settled.
The cost of living for people here has risen anywhere from 60 to 70%.
Nadim Talawi is mayor of Mahamra, a Lebanese town adjacent to Nahr al-Bared. He says families are going into debt. And despite the dislike many Lebanese feel towards Palestinians, they want them back. More specifically, they want the cheaper cost of living the Palestinian merchants ensured.
People feel the economic situation will improve once the Palestinians return, and we pray for their return.
And it looks like their prayers may be answered. This month, the United Nations began providing temporary housing to Palestinians who want to start over once again. In Lebanon, I'm Don Duncan for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note as we wrap things up for the week, we got a glimpse into the mind of Alan Greenspan today. And it seems a year after the attacks of September 11th, he wasn't worried so much about a recession. Deflation, falling prices were his primary concern. The Fed released transcripts of a 2002 meeting today. And at that meeting, on November 6th of that year, Mr. Greenspan said the U.S. was experiencing, and here I quote, a latent deflationary type of economy. Kind of sounds like him, doesn't it? Anyway, that day, the Fed cut interest rates half a percentage point. It was the only rate cut that year, but it did push the federal funds rate to a 41-year low. Greenspan, as you might know, has come in for a lot of criticism that he kept rates too low for too long. Also, voting for that half-point cut, by the way, the Federal Open Market Committee's newest member at the time, a guy named Bernanke. That is Marketplace on this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 256 points, 2%. The Nasdaq fell 61 points, 2.6%. The S&P 500 lost 27 points. That is 2% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, tracking the critical mass behind causes on the web.
What I think it might do is to take the people who would have acted anyway, and instead of wasting their time trying to find a community that's not going to go anywhere, switch your resources and your time and your effort to a movement that's going to have more impact.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.